All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale. Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve. Gauravani Pracharane. Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskatyade Satarane. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam. Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha. Panchakalpati Vishchaki Pasindaviyavata Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavabhi Namo Namah. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 January 24th, 2024, in Brisbane, Australia, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 9, Text 29. This is Dhruva Maharaj returns home. Maitreya Uvacha.
Maitreya
Uvacha.
Matu Sapatnya Vagbanayar.
Matu
Sapna Vagbanayar. Uredi Vedas Tutan Smaran.
Uredi Vedas Tutan Smaran.
Naicham Mukti Pater Muktim.
Naicham Mukti Pater Muktim.
Tasmatapan Upe Ivan. Please check. Maitreya Uvacha.
Maitreya
Uvacha.
The great sage Maitreya replied. Matuhu.
Matuhu.
Of his mother.
Of his mother.
Sapatnyaha.
Sapatnyaha.
Of the co-wife.
Vakbanai.
Of the arrows of harsh words. Riddhi.
In the heart.
Vidha.
Vidha.
Pierced.
Yes.
Two. Then. Tan. All of them.
All of them.
Smaram. Remembering.
Remembering.
Na.
Na.
Not.
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 Achat.
Achat.
Desired.
Desired.
Mukti Patehe.
Mukti Patehe.
From the Lord whose lotus feet give liberation.
Liberation.
Muktim. Salvation. Tasmat.
Therefore.
Tapam.
Tapam.
Grief.
Grief.
Upeyivan. He suffered. Srila Prabhupada's translation. Maitreya answered, Dhruva Maharaj's heart, which was pierced by the arrows of the harsh words of his stepmother, was greatly aggrieved. And thus when he fixed upon his goal of life, he did not forget her misbehavior. He did not demand actual liberation from this material world, but at the end of his devotional service, when the Supreme Personality of God had appeared before him, he was simply ashamed of the material demands he had in his mind. This is a long purport. Srila Prabhupada's purport. This important verse has been discussed by many stalwart commentators. Why was Dhruva Maharaj not very pleased, even after achieving the goal of life he desired? A pure devotee is always free from any kind of material desires. In the material world, one's material desires are almost demonic. One thinks of others as one's enemies. One thinks of revenge against one's enemies. One aspires to become the topmost leader or topmost person in this material world, and thus one competes with all others. This has been described in the Bhagavad Gita 16th chapter as asuric. A pure devotee has no demand from the Lord. His only concern is to serve the Lord sincerely and seriously, and he is not at all concerned about what will happen in the future. In the Mukunda Mala Stotra, King Kulashekar, author of the book, states in his prayer, "My dear Lord, I don't want any position of sense gratification within this material world. I simply want to engage in your service perpetually." Similarly, Lord Chaitanya in his Shikshasika also prayed, "My Lord, I do not want any amount of material wealth. I do not want any number of materialistic followers, nor do I want an attractive wife to enjoy. The only thing I want is that I may engage life after life in your service." Lord Chaitanya did not even pray for mukti or liberation. In this verse, Maitreya replied to Vidura that Dhruva Maharaj, influenced by a revengeful attitude towards his insulting stepmother, did not think of mukti, nor did he know what mukti was. So this was the point we made yesterday. Therefore, he failed to aim for mukti as his goal in life. But a pure devotee also does not want liberation. He is a soul completely surrendered to the Supreme Lord, and he does not demand anything from the Lord. This position was realized by Dhruva Maharaj when he saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead present personally before him, because he was elevated to the Vasudeva platform. The Vasudeva platform refers to the stage at which material contamination is conspicuous by absence only, or in other words, where there is no question of the material modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, and one can therefore see the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because on the Vasudeva platform one can see God face to face, the Lord is also called Vasudeva. Dhruva Maharaj's demand was for a position so exalted that it was never enjoyed even by Lord Brahma, his great-grandfather. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is so affectionate and kind toward his devotees, especially to a devotee like Dhruva Maharaj, who went to render devotional service in the forest alone at the age of only 5 years, that although the motive may be impure, the Lord does not consider the motive. He is concerned with the service. But if a devotee has a particular motive, the Lord directly or indirectly knows it, and therefore he does not leave the devotee's material desires unfulfilled. These are some of the special favors by the Lord to a devotee. Dhruva Maharaj was offered Dhruva Loka, a planet that was never resided upon by any conditioned soul. Even Brahma, although the topmost living creature within this universe, was not allowed to enter the Dhruva Loka. Wherever there is a crisis within this universe, the demigods go to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Kshiradakshai Vishnu, and they stand on the beach of the milk ocean. So the fulfillment of Dhruva Maharaj's demand, a position more exalted than that of even his great-grandfather Brahma, was offered to him. Here in this verse, the Lord is described as Muktipati, which means one under whose lotus feet there are all kinds of mukti. There are five kinds of mukti: Sayuja, Swarupya, Saloka, Samipya, and Sarshti. Out of these five muktis, which can be achieved by any person engaged in devotional service to the Lord, the one which is known as Sayuja is generally demanded by Mayavadi philosophers. They demand to become one with the impersonal Brahman effulgence of the Lord. In the opinion of many scholars, the Sayuja Mukti, although counted among the five kinds of Mukti, is not actually Mukti, because from Sayuja Mukti one may again fall down to this material world. This information we have from Srimad Bhagavatam 10.2.32, wherein it is said Pachantada, which means they again fall down. The monist philosopher, after executing severe austerity, merges into the impersonal effulgence of the Lord, but the living entity always wants reciprocation in loving affairs. Therefore, although the monist philosopher is elevated to the status of being one with the effulgence of the Lord, because there is no facility for associating with the Lord and rendering service unto him, he again falls into this material world, and his service propensity is satisfied by materialistic welfare activities like humanitarianism, altruism, and philanthropy. There are many instances of such fall downs, even for great sannyasis, in the Mayavada school. Therefore, Vaishnava philosophers do not accept Sayuja Mukti to be within the category of Mukti. According to them, Mukti means transferal to the loving service of the Lord from one's position of serving Maya. Lord Chaitanya also says in this connection that the constitutional position of a living entity, some people have to mute, is to render service to the Lord. That is real Mukti. When one is situated in his original position, giving up artificial positions, he is called mukta or liberated. In the Bhagavad Gita, this is confirmed. Anyone who is engaged in rendering transcendental loving service to the Lord is considered to be mukta or brahma-bhuta. Srimad Bhagavatam 4:30-20. But that's funny, because Prabhupada is quoting, say, from the Bhagavad Gita, and then there's a reference. I mean, Prabhupada's quoting Brahma Bhutya Prasanat Manasocha Chinna Kanchati, or else he's chanting he's referencing Mamtayo Vyavicharina Bhakti Yogana Sevite Sagunan Samatichatam Brahma Bhuyaya Kalpate, probably that one. So I don't know why BBT editors put in Bhagavatam verse. Anyway, it is said in Bhagavad Gita that as a devotee is considered to be on the Brahma Bhutya platform when he has no material contamination. In the Padma Purana, this is also confirmed. Mukti means engagement in the service of the Lord. The great sage Maitreya explained that Dhruva Maharaj did not desire in the beginning to engage in the service of the Lord, but he wanted an exalted position better than his great-grandfather's. This is more or less not service to the Lord, but service to the senses. Even if one gets the position of Brahma, the most exalted position in this material world, he is a conditioned soul. Srila Prabodhananda Sarasvati says that if one is elevated to real pure devotional service, he considers even great demigods like Brahma and Indra to be at an equal level with an insignificant insect. The reason is that an insignificant insect has a desire for sense gratification, and even a great personality like Lord Brahma also wants to dominate this material nature. Sense gratification means domination over material nature. The whole competition between conditioned souls is based upon domination of this material nature. Modern scientists are proud of their knowledge because they are discovering new methods to dominate the laws of material nature. They think that this is the advancement of human civilization. The more they can dominate the material laws, the more advanced they think they are. Dhruva Maharaj's propensity in the beginning was like that. He wanted to dominate this material world in a greater position than Lord Brahma. Therefore, elsewhere it is described that after the appearance of the Lord, when Dhruva Maharaj thought and compared his determination to his final reward, he realized that he had wanted a few particles of broken glass, but instead had received many diamonds. As soon as he saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face, he immediately became conscious of the unimportance of his demand from the Lord to have an exalted position better than Lord Brahma's. When Dhruva Maharaj became situated on the Vasudeva platform, due to seeing the Lord face to face, all his material contamination was cleared. Thus he became ashamed of what his demands were and what he had achieved. He was very much ashamed to think that although he had gone to Madhuvan, giving up the kingdom of his father, and he had gotten a spiritual master like Narada Muni, he was still thinking of revenge against his stepmother and wanted to occupy an exalted post within this material world. These were the causes for his moroseness, even after he received all the desired benedictions from the Lord. When Dhruva Maharaj factually saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there is no question of a revengeful attitude towards his stepmother, nor any aspiration to lord it over the material world. But the Supreme Personality is so kind that he knew that Dhruva Maharaj wanted these. Speaking before Dhruva Maharaj, he used the word Vedaham, because when Dhruva Maharaj demanded material benefits, the Lord was present within his heart and so knew everything. The Lord always knows everything a man is thinking. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita also. Vedaham Samatitani, Bhagavad Gita 7:26. The Lord fulfilled all Dhruva Maharaj's desires. His revengeful attitude toward his stepmother and stepbrother was satisfied. His desire for a more exalted position than that of his great-grandfather was also fulfilled. And at the same time, his eternal position in Dhruva Loka was fixed. Although Dhruva Maharaj's achievements of an eternal planet was not conceived of by him, Krishna thought, what will Dhruva do with an exalted position within this material world? Therefore, he gave Dhruva an opportunity to rule this material world for 36,000 years with unchangeable senses and the chance to perform many great sacrifices and thus become the most reputed king within this material world. And after finishing with all this material enjoyment, Dhruva would be promoted to the spiritual world, which includes the Dhruva Loka. Maitreya Uvacha Matu Sapnya Vagmanar Ridi Vidas Tutan Smaran Naichan Muktir Pater Muktin Tasma Tapan Upeyivan. Maitreya answered Dhruva Maharaj's heart, which was pierced by the arrows of the harsh words of his stepmother, was greatly aggrieved. And thus when he fixed upon his goal of life, he did not forget her misbehavior. He did not demand actual liberation from this material world, but the end of his devotional service, when the Supreme Personality of God had appeared before him, he was deeply ashamed of the material world, material demands he had in his mind. So Srila Prabhupada is looking primarily at the Mukti Pate Muktin. Here he's mostly talking about what is Mukti, but he's also talking about how Dhruva Maharaj wanted vengeance. Yes. And Prabhupada here is defining what we get a liberation from. What does it mean to get liberation? As being free from this desire for vengeance, being free from a desire to lord it over others. And so Dhruva Maharaj came to this, to the worship of the Lord, with a desire to lord it over others, and with a desire for vengeance, with a feeling of being insulted. But he ended up getting freedom from that false ego and being engaged in the Lord's service. All right, so I thought we would look at this problem of being insulted and this problem of wanting vengeance as being indicative of our false ego, indicative of our desire to lord it over, and then look at what does mukti mean? How do we attain freedom from this false ego? And then we will look at the Lord's kindness, which is actually rather astonishing and bewildering and seemingly, like we looked yesterday, at a seeming contradiction. So it's also seemingly contradictory to what we understand of pure devotional service. So this problem with being insulted and feeling wanting some kind of retribution, you know, wanting to attack others, wanting vengeance on others, wanting to harm those who harm us, is pervasive in this world. And we have to say that it's also pervasive even in the society of devotees. And we may wonder about this, but we can look here at Bhagavatam 11:23-2 and 3, where Lord Krishna is talking to Uddhava. And Krishna says something very amazing here. He says, O disciple of Brihaspati, there is virtually no saintly man in this world capable of resettling his own mind after it has been disturbed by the insulting words of uncivilized men. And in the next verse, text 3, he says, sharp arrows which pierce one's chest and reach the heart do not cause as much suffering as the arrows of harsh, insulting words that become lodged within the heart when spoken by uncivilized men. So Krishna is saying that physical arrows that go into our physical heart are not as painful as insulting words. And he says that even a sadhu, he uses the word sadhur vai dur jan er hitai, that a saintly person, even a saintly person, and then he says, disturb binam. Binam means separateness. Binam atmanam. And he says that he can't do it. He can't do it. Ishvaraha is capable. One is not able to be the controller of his mind and cannot. Samadhatum, he cannot be the controller of his mind. It becomes very difficult. So a great saintly person, a sadhu, when he is pierced by these arrows of insulting words, cannot become the Ishwara, the controller of his mind. His mind becomes very disturbed. More so, than if we were pierced by an arrow in the heart. So I haven't been pierced by any arrows physical in my heart in this life, But I can just imagine, you know, if I'm even pricked by a thorn, it's where I'm going, ow, 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 it's very painful. What to speak of if there was an arrow in the heart? And here we have this same terminology being used. Vak banai, the arrows of harsh words, riddhi in the heart, vidaha pierced. That Dhruva's heart was pierced by these arrows. So why is it that being insulted is so painful and that we have this natural urge for vengeance? So our body and mind is designed, it's a machine designed by the Lord for the preservation of our body and mind. It's got a self-preservation code put into it, so to speak. For example, you know, if there's some physical threat, if somebody is pointing an arrow at you, or if someone's pointing a gun at you, or if there's, you know, a pack of barking dogs in a narrow alley, or a tiger, or, you know, if there's somebody, there's some physical threat to the body's existence, the body sets up a system of defense. I mean, you can think of it like a fire detector, smoke detector in a house, that when there's a certain amount of smoke, that the smoke detector rings, and in some establishments, if there is detection of fire, it will set off a sprinkler system to pour water on the fire. It's an automatic thing. It's set up with an automatic sensor that when there's smoke detection, their alarm rings, maybe the fire department is called, and so forth. So our body has this as well, that if our senses detect some kind of a threat, that it's very fast, because after all, if somebody's going to shoot you with an arrow, you may need to respond within a fraction of a second. And so the amygdala part of our brain, if the senses, if the eyes, the ears, the sense of touch, whatever, detect some kind of physical threat, the amygdala only has two settings for this. Definitely it's a threat, and maybe it's a threat. It doesn't have a, no, it's not a threat, because the body has to respond very quickly. So the amygdala then signals the body to release what's called the stress hormones, like cortisol and adrenaline, that ready the body to deal with the threat. So these stress hormones, they get the body ready for what we call the fight or flight response. And recently, there's been added to this freeze and fawn, F-A-W-N. So if we're being attacked, we either fight the attacker, or we run away from the attacker, or we freeze, you know, like animals will freeze to become camouflage, or we may submit to the attacker. Like some animals, when they're threatened, you know, they'll lie on their back and they'll show their belly, you know, and they submit. Don't hurt me, don't hurt me. So there are these four stress responses that the body does with an enemy. And we should note very carefully that this stress response of the body to being attacked, it has several effects in the body. Because if you've got to run away or fight with a pack of dogs, so you don't want to be discussing philosophy, you know, or doing calculus equations. So the higher order thinking becomes paused. The energy going to digesting food becomes paused. One's immune system becomes paused. All of those things are put on pause. And great energy is given to kind of the lower portions of the brain, the more animalistic parts of the brain, and to our arms and legs. Now, this machine of our body and mind is also programmed to respond in exactly the same way to social threats or to verbal threats. And the reason for this is quite simple. First of all, a verbal threat may be followed up by physical action. So if someone says, you know, I'm going to hit you, they may then hit you. And therefore, those threatening words, the amygdala is going to understand in the same way as a threatening action. Furthermore, because we human beings are social creatures, we are among the herd animals, it's very difficult for us to maintain ourselves as a solitary being. You know, there's always some stories about someone abandoned on a desert island alone. But it's actually quite difficult to do that. In normal life, we depend on others for so many things. We depend on others for food, for shelter, for transportation, for basically everything that we need in life. And some people we depend on more than others. So you're a little five-year-old child, you're depending on your parents a lot, right? Or right, if you're married, you have a lot of dependence on your spouse. Or, you know, if you're working for a business, you have a lot of dependence on your boss. So certain, we're dependent in general on our social circles, and there are certain people on whom we're especially dependent to get what we need to live. So if those people insult us, threaten us, you know, even criticize us mildly, the amygdala can interpret that as a threat. And remember that the amygdala has a fraction of a second to make this determination, could this possibly be a threat? And when that happens, then this whole danger system called the sympathetic nervous system is activated. And please keep in mind that this system is pausing our higher order thinking skills. You can think of when Krishna talks about contemplation, attachment, lust, anger. And in anger, there's delusion, bewilderment of memory, and intelligence is lost. So the sensations in our body of these stress hormones, we generally call anger or fear, and they definitely take away our memory and our intelligence. And then our natural biological response is to fight with our enemy. Now, if our enemy is using harsh words, then we want to use harsh words back, or we want to get this person out of our way. You know, we want to eliminate them somehow so they can't threaten us, so we're no longer dependent on them. So this is a natural biological response, and in one sense, it's a biological response that's built into the body out of the Lord's kindness. But we are particularly affected by this response, and will have an inclination to act on this response automatically if we have false ego, if we're identifying with the body and the mind and we want to control the material nature. If I want to be the controller of material nature and I am thus identifying with my body and my mind, then I will also strongly identify with these urges of fight, flight, freeze, or fawn that occur in my body when my body detects some sort of threat. We see this phenomena on a global scale in war. You know, one country says, well, this country is threatening me, and therefore I'm going to attack, and then the other country says, you've attacked me, now I'm going to attack you back. But it happens on a mini scale all the time. Once you become aware of this fact, you'll start seeing it everywhere. And some people, I mean, depending on what Prabhupada talks about being above the gunas here in this purport, depending on how low you are in the gunas, then your false ego is stronger and you're more prone to an immediate reaction when this feeling of threat arises. So someone in tamagun is going to strongly want to control the world, strongly identify with their body and mind, and therefore when this response kicks in, they're going to act very quickly. In other words, someone in tamagun is going to perceive very insignificant things as a threat. So you just look at somebody sideways. Oh, are you threatening me? You disrespecting me? In tamagun, people are going to interpret or understand very minor things as severe threats and immediately jump to retaliation without thought. I mean, certainly a lot of criminals are in this category, but anyone who's heavily in tamagun, anyone who takes a lot of intoxication and eats meat and is very lazy, is going to end up, their response level is very low. They're in a constant state of watchfulness and fear. Then in rajagun, it's going to be less. In rajagun, there's more of a sense of honor and righteousness and tolerance, the qualities that are mentioned in rajagun. And therefore, people in rajagun have a more ability to tolerate and accept very low-level threats without seeing them as threats. They just don't interpret a low-level threat as a threat. Their threshold is higher and they don't go into this fear and anger response as easily. Someone in sattvagun doesn't interpret practically anything as a threat. It takes a lot for someone in sattvagun to go into this threat fear response, although it does happen. And therefore we find so many examples in the scripture of sages who end up cursing somebody because they felt insulted. And that's why Krishna says again in the 11th canto that even if you're a sadhu, that tolerating insulting words is going to be extremely difficult. But by the way, by toleration, we don't mean repression. So this is this response to the danger signal, this response that we have to the sympathetic nervous system, is one of the key indicators of how much we're affected by the false ego. I mean, if we want to see to what extent do I want to enjoy the material world and to what extent am I affected by the false ego, one of our key indicators is how much do I identify with and do I have an instant response to this biological phenomena that happens in my body and mind as a response to feeling threatened, especially when the threats come in the form of insulting words or criticisms or things like this. Right? And this Radhana Swami likes to quote, you know, that a person's greatness is understood by their ability to tolerate provoking circumstances. So it's an excellent gauge. Somebody who feels very easily offended and very quickly wants to retaliate without much thought is has much stronger influence in the gunas of false ego. And again, it can be apparently like minor things. You know, if you say to somebody, hey, you know, you said you'd be here at 6 o'clock and you weren't here until 7 and, you know, things were disturbed because you weren't here. And if someone takes this as an insult and then they respond that, well, you're sometimes late. Well, you're not perfect. Why are you criticizing me? That's taking a very minor statement of fact as a threat and responding with a counterattack, wanting some kind of vengeance. Or, I'm not even going to come anymore. I'm not even going to come have anything to do with you anymore. Trying to eliminate the other person. So this kind of, we see this very frequently in human relations. You know, that there's people that if you say anything to them, you know, hey, you left the milk out of the refrigerator and it started to go bad. You know, you're just talking about a fact, you know, and I'm kind of concerned because we spend a lot of money on this milk and, you know, milk is liquid religion and I really don't want it to go bad. You know. Well, I was busy. Why are you giving me a hard time? You sometimes forget things too. You know, this kind of counterattack is very common. So mukti means freedom from this. And instead engaging in the service. So Prabhupada talks about the five kinds of liberations, a topic he talks about quite often, and that merging into the Lord is not real liberation because one, again, falls down from there looking for loving exchanges. And I've actually read some interesting stories of people who, in the modern age, achieved Brahman realization and decided to come back to the mundane level in order to have relationships. But Prabhupada makes the point that with the four kinds of liberation, the essence are engagement in service and giving up this demonic, which he calls demoniac, desire to be the controller of the world. Not being concerned. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. That doesn't mean, by the way, that if a car is barreling down the street and our amygdala senses danger, that we just walk in front of the car. That's not what it means. It's devotees are not fools. Although we do have some avadutas like Rishabhdev and Jadbhadatta who basically became almost completely non-reactive. You know, Jadbhadatta, who was about to be killed, he was about to be beheaded in front of the goddess Kali, and he did nothing whatsoever to protect himself. So we do have some instances like that, although that's only applicable to somebody who's living and working completely outside society, and whose service to the Lord is completely internal. But the goal is that our mood should be service rather than protection of the false ego. Now, service certainly includes that we protect the body and the mind. They're Krishna's
Just like we protect a car that we are driving because it belongs to Krishna, we protect the building because it's Krishna's temple, and so forth. But we're seeing it as service. And whatever happens, Madhe Krishna Rake K, Rake Krishna Mari K, if Krishna wants to kill me, no one can save me. If Krishna wants to save me, no one can kill me. Sampare Vipare Jivane Madane. I am yours whether there's it's happiness or distress, whether you kill me or protect me. The devotee is just, they don't see any need to protect their false ego because they don't have any false ego to protect. And Prabhupada is referring here in this purport to Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who says, Jivera Swarupaya Krishnara Nityadasa, I am Krishna's servant. No one can take that away from me. Someone can take away my home. Someone can take away my hand. They can cut my hand off. Somebody can steal my money. Somebody can, you know, say lies about me and take away my reputation and my respect in a community. People can refuse to feed me. I mean, so on so many levels, people can definitely hurt me on the bodily and mental, social level. But on the level of devotional service to Krishna, no one can ever take that away from me. The only person who can take that away from me is me. It's my constitutional position. It's my, as Prabhupada says here, my original position. I am a servant of Krishna. It's what I am. It's not something bestowed on me. It's what I am. It is my intrinsic nature. And when I accept that, when I embrace that, then nobody can remove it from me. I mean, I can remove it from myself by being offensive or by being in my false ego. That removes it from I'm removing myself from the situation. But so what is there to fear? I am an eternal soul. Na jayate miyate bhakadachin nayam bhutra bhavitam bhanabhuyaha ajonita shasvatoyam parano nahanyate hanyamane shirire. I'm an eternal soul and my service to Krishna, jivera swarupaya krishnera nityadasa, I'm always a servant of Krishna. No, what is there to fear? Who can attack that? I can't be hurt by wind, by water, by arrows, by anything. Certainly can't be hurt by insulting words. There's nothing that can affect me. And therefore, one who's on that platform firmly, which is above Sattva-gun, as Prabhupada makes the point here, it's on the Vasudev platform, they don't react to this. Now, this non-reaction is not repression. So we all learn as children to repress emotion because we get in trouble for exhibiting anger and so forth. But repression is just simply aversion. And it's not stable. When you repress emotions, sooner or later those emotions will erupt. I knew one couple that got divorced after 10 years of marriage because the wife just all of a sudden started talking about all the things in the last 10 years her husband had done that bothered her. And instead of dealing with it at the time, in a constructive way, she had bottled it all up. And when it exploded, it was like a huge volcano, and there was no way to save that marriage, unfortunately. Very unfortunate, on many levels. So that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about repression that ends up showing its head in some other form or at some later date, and causes actually an ongoing stress response in the body and an ongoing lack of higher order thinking skills. But we're talking about a disinterest. Like Krishna talks about one who's, you know, equipoised in honor and dishonor, fame and infamy. One who sees alike the friends, the enemies, and the neutral. Why? Because we're not identifying with this body and this mind and the things of this world. We're identifying with Krishna's service. I can do Krishna's service internally in my consciousness, and I can see every situation as an opportunity for service. Prahlad Maharaj saw his father's abuse of him as an opportunity for service. Haridas Thakur saw his being beaten in marketplaces as an opportunity for service. And here we have, you know, Dhruva was effectively disinherited and exiled by his stepmother. You know, the Pandavas were disinherited and exiled. Bhishma was disinherited and exiled. Vidura was disinherited and exiled. And they saw it as an opportunity for service. A different kind of service, perhaps, but an opportunity for service. And therefore, they were not disturbed. We should note carefully that the reaction in the body will still take place in a liberated soul, such as explained in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 14:22-25. that the physical body will still be acted upon by the modes. In other words, when someone insults you, if you're a liberated soul and someone insults you, the amygdala will still set out the alarm for the sympathetic nervous system. That will not stop happening. But what will happen is that you won't identify with it. You won't think this is me. And therefore you will not feel a need to either act upon it or repress it. You become the observer of it. And if you're absorbed in Krishna's service, you hardly even really notice it. This phenomena is nicely explained in the fifth canto in reference to Jatabharata, where it says that when he was insulted by King Rahuvana, he felt waves of dissatisfaction within his mind, but he neglected them. Quite different to what's being described here, where Dhruva Maharaj felt his stepmother's insulting words like a physical arrow in the heart. Whereas Jatabharata, although the body reacted, he didn't feel it like a heart arrow. He felt it just like some kind of waves that were passing through him. So that's what liberation means. And interestingly enough, this liberation is not just a result, but it also is part of sadhana. So as part of our sadhana, we're supposed to practice this. And such is explained in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So if someone thinks, though, this equal-mindedness among pleasant and unpleasant events, it's a symptom of pure devotional service, and so right now I have to be disturbed. So the first thing is true, but the second thing is not. Yes, being completely even-minded among pleasant and unpleasant events is a symptom of liberation. However, it doesn't mean that because now I'm not liberated, that I just have to act like somebody in tamagun. It's part of our sadhana, according to the Bhagavad Gita, to practice this detachment. Krishna explains this nicely right after he describes the fall-down sequence in 262 and 63. In 264, he describes being free from attachment and aversion. And in 270, he talks about a metaphor that just like the rivers are flowing into the ocean, which is always being filled but is ever still. Now one can say this is very difficult, that's a fact, but the Lord is very kind and he gives us help. In Bhagavad Gita 2:64, he says when you try to do this to please him, he gives you Bhagavad Prasadam. That doesn't mean samosas, although he gives us samosas as well, but it means that he gives us his help and his mercy. And I wanted to look at, just briefly here, something astonishing that Srila Prabhupada says in the purport about the mercy of the Lord. So Dhruva Maharaj didn't feel that there was anything wrong with his vengeful attitude towards his stepmother and stepbrother. He didn't perceive his attitude as being a symptom of false ego or a symptom of being affected by the modes. I mean, after all, he was a 5-year-old child. So he didn't think there was anything wrong with his desire for vengeance and his desire for a kingdom greater than his grandfather, great-grandfather, Brahma. He didn't see any problem with that at all. He didn't want to be free of that. He didn't want liberation, as Prabhupada says here. He didn't even know about liberation. Prabhupada says he didn't think of mukti, nor did he know what mukti was. He didn't even know that that was available. He didn't even know that that was desirable. And so, therefore, Prabhupada said he really wasn't serving Krishna. Prabhupada says here, it wasn't really service. It was really sense gratification. So he was just trying to use the Lord for his own purposes of overlording the material world. I mean, if somebody, and we all have this situation, that people are nice to us and do things for us because they think we can give them something. You know, when I was growing up, this was very common. My parents were very influential, wealthy people. And they were regularly aware of the fact that people would be nice to them because they were hoping to get something. They were hoping to get some influence or they were hoping to get some money. And in fact, my family, when we would travel, we would often use a pseudonym to hide our identity, to avoid this kind of a problem. So that sort of thing is not service, really. You know, Prabhupada talks about the person who serves you because they want to be paid. They're not really serving you because they want to serve you. They're serving you just because they want to get something from you. And again, this is it's not love. So Dhruva Maharaj was not really in that sense even doing service. But Srila Prabhupada says here in this purport that the Lord wasn't looking at Dhruva's motive, he was only looking at the external service that was rendered. Okay, Dhruva Maharaj is doing something nice for me externally, so never mind what his motive is, never mind that, his, you know, I'll still give him everything material and spiritual. So Krishna does this. He definitely doesn't do it all the time, but he does it sometimes. The most notable example, of course, is Putana, where not only was she trying, I mean, she was trying to kill the Lord. So it's a far, far more extreme situation than what we're looking at here in Dhruva. And still, she went to the spiritual world and became in Vatsalya Bhav. Now, generally, the intent and the motive in bhakti is more important than the externals. Far more important. I always like to give the example of Ram Das Vilas, who was traveling with Raghunath Bhatta Goswami and assisting him with his bags, and always chanting Ram, 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 Ram. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't pay any attention to him, although he had been rendering service to a Mahabhagavata devotee, and he was always chanting the holy name, because his desire was for Sayuja Mukti. So the Lord took the intent and the desire as practically everything, and the external service as practically nothing. In fact, Sri Rupa Goswami defines like that, Anya Bilasita Sunyam, Gyanakarma Anavatam, Anukulena Krishna Anushilanam Bhakti Uttamam. His description of pure devotional service is when we're not calculating what we're going to get from the Lord, and we're only relying on bhakti. We're not covering our bhakti with jnana yoga and karma yoga or dhyana yoga. And our desire is to please the Lord just to please the Lord. Our happiness is just seeing that the Lord is happy. We're not trying to please the Lord as a means to achieve something, but we're trying to please the Lord just because we want to please the Lord. I mean, in our material dealings, we have this kind of situation. You know, you're playing with a baby just to get the baby to smile. The baby's not going to do anything for you. What can the baby do for you? But it's just so pleasurable, you know, to see the baby smile, to hear the baby laugh. is such a pleasure that you'll play with the baby simply for that purpose. Now, people do this with their animals. They play with their animals just to see the animal happy. Their happiness is the happiness of the animal. So this is the idea with Krishna, that we want to please Krishna just to please Krishna. And without that, Krishna's not usually interested in the externals. Patram pushpam palam twayam yo me bhakti prayatati tadaham bhakti paritam ashnami prayatatmanaha. And Prabhupada says repeatedly that what Krishna's interested in is the love. Like Duryodhana made this huge feast, and Krishna's like, no, I'm not interested, I'm going to Vidura's house. And Vidura and his wife accidentally offered banana peels, and Krishna ate them. So the overwhelming statements of the Shastra and Acharyas and the examples is that Krishna is not so interested with the externals. He's interested in the motive and the intent. Of course, the externals matter. You know, you can't offer Krishna, you know, cow flesh with a good intent. If you're trying to please Krishna, you have to know something about what pleases Krishna. You have to please Krishna as Krishna desires to be pleased. But if you're ignorant, like, what was her name? In the forest with Ram and Lakshman, where she was giving him berries that she had eaten bites of. If you're ignorant, Krishna doesn't take that very seriously. But sometimes Krishna takes the externals, even if the internals are messed up. And usually we call this agyata sukriti, where Krishna counts as service something that's not intended as service. In fact, something that the person may not even have any awareness at all, agyata, that they're doing service. However, we should not take advantage of this. We should not take advantage of Krishna's kindness, because then it doesn't actually function like that. If we're going to say, well, I'm just going to do something superficially as service, but my mind will be elsewhere. Like Prabhupada was asked, do we make more advancement if we live in the temple? And Prabhupada said that depends on whether or not his mind is on another subject matter. So although Krishna will do this, although he will count the external thing and disregard the motive and the intent and the desires, he will do that. It's not what he generally does. generally he has the desires, the motive, the intent as the primary thing that he looks at, rather than the actions and the result. So if we really want to achieve the best thing, we need to know what the best thing is, and we need to aim for the best thing, and we need to be working for that best thing, which is the ultimate form of liberation. And the ultimate form of liberation is to have a mood of selfless service and to let go of the false ego. So sorry we went so long, but the purport was very long. It took up most of the class. So because of that, I don't think, unfortunately, that we have time for questions or discussions today. So I want to thank you very much for this opportunity. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai. Jai